I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, I'll be speaking with Brian Shaughnessy. Brian is a writer, visual artist, and self-described, mostly reformed hooligan. I asked Brian on the show because he has two new essays out through the Modern Mythology Collective, which, full disclosure, I also contribute to. The first essay, Liv and Maddie and Metamodernism, details the surprising links that can be made between a Disney Channel kids show and certain philosophical ideas in vogue today. The second is a tribute to the recently passed away celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain, entitled To the Bone. In the course of my discussion with Brian Shaughnessy, we discuss both these essays, as well as Brian's punk rock past, the struggle between sincerity and cynicism in culture, wrestling with personal regrets, and Brian's general outlook on life. To transition into the interview, I'm going to be playing a hardcore punk track in honor of Brian's roots in that scene by the band Human Animal called Down We Go Again.
Down we go again! Devil take his aim. Always searching, almost giving up, trying. Trusting through the depths, never getting to break. Can you hold your breath without dying? Fear it and think I wanna live this way. Fear it and think that I don't wanna change. I'm trying, I'm trying, I'm trying to be something. I'm trying.
Welcome to Parallax Views, Brian Shaughnessy.
Hey.
So I wanted to have you on because you wrote two articles recently for Jamie Curcio's Modern Mythology website. Shout out to Jamie. He helps with the podcast. The one is called Liv and Maddie and Metamodernism, and the other is called To the Bone. It's a tribute to Anthony Bourdain. Let's start with the Liv and Maddie and Metamodernism essay. It's kind of interesting that you did this essay because you sort of come from a different background than this Liv and Maddie. It's a Disney show, but you come from a little bit of a different background, the sort of a hardcore punk scene.
Very true. Yeah, I mean, when I was, you know, sophomore in high school, is maybe a little bit before that, like probably the summer freshman going into sophomore years, when I kind of really got into the punk scene. I'd been a skater since like elementary school, so it had always been kind of in the background, but that was when I got old enough to, you know, actually participate and contribute to the culture. You know, and kind of one of my favorite shows around the same time I was getting into skateboarding was You Can't Do That on Television. And that's kind of probably where my sort of fascination with a specific kind of children's programming started. One that's, you know, I mean, you know, they're not all created equal for sure. Some of them are smarter than others. And that was, I think, kind of where I saw that interest take root.
Right. Right. And I mean, it's just interesting because you even note at the beginning of the article that you were worried some people may have like seen it as being like weird that you'd be into a kid's show, knowing that you're like the guy that has listened to like stuff like Integrity and these hardcore bands and whatnot.
Yeah, for sure. I think like, yeah, I mean, for anybody who's, you know, familiar with my artistic output, it doesn't seem to match. I think it was also just, you know, it was one thing to be, you know, into kids shows when you're younger, but when you're now, you know, I'm 40 now. So that there's kind of a weirdness to that too. Like I'm clearly, even my background aside, clearly not the demographic for a show like that. But for me, like good storytelling is good storytelling. And I think, like I note in the article, I think sometimes with children's programming in particular, even though you definitely lose some stuff on the production value end of things, and of course, like, you know, younger people just starting out, you know, have not perfected their acting chops the way you might see in some adult programs. But I think particularly because a lot of times there's not as much focus on those shows being like critically and commercially successful in the same way, that the writers can kind of sometimes take some creative angles in there that you can't really get away with in adult programming. So I kind of like it from that standpoint. It's also just one of those things where it's like, you know, the world is pretty stressful, obviously. And, you know, a lot of my own art, even though I like to think there's kind of a silver lining weaving through it, is definitely kind of a little bit more bleak. So a lot of times, you know, what I like to consume is something that, you know, has a slightly more a positive note and can kind of take me out of that depression that unfortunately modern life can sometimes provoke.
Well, two things there. The first is, it's kind of interesting. If you look at the history of children's shows and sort of kids shows, there's always been a lot of kids shows that are actually like fairly subversive culturally. Shows like Airy Indiana, which was very postmodernist in its take on things. Even shows like SpongeBob, you know, that all the college kids like now, you know, there's like episodes referencing like gay marriage and stuff before that was like, you know, really acceptable in the discourse. What do you think of like kids shows and their potential for subversiveness?
Yeah, I think that's a huge thing. Like my first kind of like kid show that I got super into, like I was talking about, You Can't Do That on Television, like. In a very early draft of that Liv and Maddie article, I was kind of trying to trace, you know, my interest before it was just kind of getting away. But the thing that was interesting to me about, so You Can't Do That on Television, I think that was probably one of the first like really postmodern shows, definitely like the first postmodern kid show. I do think there's definitely something to be said for the subversiveness, like as, you know, sort of cool as it is to hate on Disney. I actually do think, especially in the last couple years, you know, it is still a Disney product for sure. Like, they are a business, but, you know, when you've got adults arguing about whether or not we should let gay people get married or people smoke pot or any of the other kind of, like, to me, things that are just, like, so ridiculous, you know, that the adult world focuses on. You can look at some of those shows and, like, or, like, with the SpongeBob, and they're kind of already saying to kids, like, hey, these things shouldn't be a stumbling block between you and how you relate to the rest of the world and to other people. Like, it's not a big deal if somebody's gay. It's not a big deal if somebody is, you know, not cool or in the typical way, or isn't, you know, like a man's man, or isn't a girly girl. That, you know, that's one thing that on the Liv and Maddie as a series, one of the things I really appreciated about it is kind of the way they play with those stereotypes to kind of send the message to younger kids who are the demographics of, like, hey, you know, you can be a boy and like this stuff. It doesn't mean that, you know, there's something wrong with you. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're effeminate. And if you are effeminate, then there's nothing necessarily wrong with that either.
Right. And it's kind of interesting what you're hitting on there. It's become, I think I told you this when you published the article at Modern Mythology. I said that, how do I put this? I'm trying to remember what exactly I said. It used to be cool to be cynical. And now it's become so mainstream that I almost can appreciate a show like Liv and Maddie, or shows that are more sort of sincere and not mean-spirited.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like, one of my all-time favorite movies growing up was Pump Up the Volume with Christian Slater. And
I love that movie.
Such a great movie. And his character is, on one hand, you know, very cynical, you know, is definitely, you know, kind of that typical idea that we think of, like, of a Gen Xer, like, everything sucks, you know, I'm in the middle of nowhere, adults are stupid, and that's true. But I mean, the other undercurrent to that is, like, that's not a reason he doesn't give up because of that. Like, you know, that's the main thing to me, is, like, it's, you know, nobody wants to have, like, a total Pollyanna outlook necessarily. Like, there are obviously very real problems in the world. But yeah, that whole cynicism has definitely become, like, a crutch. It's just become, like, cool in scare quotes to not give a fuck about anything. And I know, like, to me, that's just kind of bullshit. And that really just even goes back, you know, to, you know, my roots in hardcore punk. Like, you know, that was, like, really the first thing that I saw where it was like, no, you should give a fuck. Like, it's okay to think that parts of the world are stupid, because some of them really are kind of bullshit, whether it's, you know, things that the government are doing, or, you know, as simple as, like, maybe your old man's a prick, whatever it is. It's okay to notice that those things suck, but, like, that's not a reason to give up. You know, and that's kind of, like, with my own art and with the art that I'm most interested in. It's like, you know, I don't want to pretend that the world is great and everything's, you know, sunshine and rainbows, but at the same time, like, as bad as things are, you got to push forward and try to find the positive, and, you know, try to not lose your sincerity. Like, that's the thing to me, I think, that really bugs me about, like, modern incarnations of cynicism is, like, you know, you're kind of letting them win, because, like, the whole thing with, like, punk is like, yeah, the world sucks, but I'm gonna raise a middle finger to that, and I'm gonna, even if it's just in my own little small corner of the world, find a way to make the world a little bit better. And I think now there's too much of this kind of, like, weird fatalism, this kind of, like, phony nihilism that, you know, you see in, like, meme culture and stuff, where it's just like everything is stupid and stupid to care about anything. And I don't know, to me, that's just, like, just weak.
Well, it's like, I grew up a lot reading Colin Wilson, who was this British philosopher associated with the Angry Young Men. And the Angry Young Men had this line. They would say, don't let the bastards grind you down. Now people seem to say, well, we're all bastards. Ha ha. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'll be, you know, the first to tell anybody, like, I've not always been an exemplary human being, for sure. I've definitely got some skeletons in my closet, and a lot of them are, you know, worse than a lot of other people I know who think they've maybe made a few mistakes in life. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of like I've always said that, you know, I don't really think that sins can be forgiven necessarily. Like, I don't think no matter what amount of good I do isn't going to make up for the terrible things I did in the past. But at the same time, like, I'm not going to let those past mistakes dictate the fact, like, well, you know, once a scumbag, always a scumbag. So why even try? Like, to me, it's like a matter of principle. It's not a matter of redemption.
So with the Liv and Maddie article, like, let's dive a little bit deeper into it. What, for my listeners that may not know, because I've come across the term before, but I've never seen it properly explained. What is metamodernism?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the reason why I've never seen it properly explained is that I think even people who have spent a lot of time and ink on the subject don't necessarily come to an agreement on it. I kind of see it, and, you know, some other people do kind of see it as an attempt to sort of bridge the chasm between modernism and postmodernism. You know, I think the so-called new sincerity is definitely a big part of that, which is kind of what we touched on a little bit earlier about not being cynical for its own sake or because you think it's cool, but to, you know, to say, like, you know, we've had enough of that. It's enough irony for irony's sake, and maybe it's actually, like, a good thing to care about things. So, yeah, I mean, those are kind of the basic themes from where I sit. You know, it's kind of, it takes a little bit of from both modernism and postmodernism, and kind of, you know, tries to, find a way forward from those two positions, which, you know, I mean, there's obviously, like anything, there's criticisms to be made of some of the work and thought that have come out under that. But, like, especially now where, you know, a large cultural, conflict seems to be, you know, status quo warriors who are convinced that, like, postmodernism is the doom of Western civilization, which is, like, kind of ironic in the sense that postmodernism, like, really hasn't been that, you know, vital for a little while. And it's certainly, I don't think, destroying the world by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, it's people that are threatened by this. They feel like the status quo is leaving them. Like, a lot of like white males and a lot of these like suburban kids and whatnot that are sort of alt-right or whatever, they're threatened by a changing society in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. It's kind of depressing too, just to think that, like, a lot of these people that I see online are in their 20s. You know, when I was in my 20s, especially, you know, being in the punk rock scene, like, I was hungry for change. I didn't want, you know, like, I thought the world sucked, you know, and in a lot of ways, like, there's still bad aspects to it, and there's still, like, really big problems, like global warming, that, like, God only knows how we're going to address that. But, like, in terms of, you know, like, when I was in my 20s, the idea that, you know, we would stop arresting people for smoking pot seemed impossible. Granted, it's, you know, it's only a few states right now, but I think that's going to change. The idea that, you know, two men who are in love or two women who are in love could marry each other just seem like totally unthinkable. And it's a little bit puzzling to me as to why you would oppose that. Is none of these changes that these guys seem so threatened by, really seem like things that are going to impact your life. Like, no one's going to show up at your house and, you know, make you get gay married or make you read, you know, the latest gender studies literature. Like, you can still go about your own life. There's plenty of traditional-ish men that are, you know, high profile. So it's weirdly hysterical to me as well. And, you know, I think it's also just the point is that, like, when you really dig into these people, like, they really are just kind of, they are what they claim to hate. And that kind of cynical dishonesty, I think, is one of the things that I like about Liv and Maddie, because it's kind of a, you know, an antidote to that. It's definitely aware of how it can be sometimes cheesy, and it's episodes that kind of get maybe, I don't want to say preachy, but like they deal with sexism pretty extensively, and it's, you know, very clear that the episode is structured around like we're going to have a discussion about sexism now. But, you know, it's self-aware of that, but it still ultimately means it, where it's like a lot of these guys that are, you know, the alt-right or whatever, the alt-light, as I like to call them, that a lot of other people like to call them, not like I meant to that, but I don't even know that they really mean like half the things they say. Like, they may even think they mean it, but I think, you know, whether the rubber hits the road, I think really it's just a reflection of their own unhappiness, their own lack of identity. And whereas, like, I think the healthy response to alienation is to actually go out and forge your own identity, they seem to be content to kind of just let the world happen to them.
So getting into this a little bit more with Liv and Maddie, I'm not as familiar with the show as you are, and I'm not sure a lot of my listeners or even people who may have read the essay are. How would you sum up the show?
So, you know, basically the show is about a family in Wisconsin. It primarily follows the siblings. The Liv and Maddie are both played by Dev Cameron. They're twin sisters, and they have a younger brother and two younger brothers. And it kind of follows them through, you know, their high school experiences. Generally, the plots are kind of set up to where those four siblings are, you know, the kind of regular guest stars who play their friends kind of get paired off in kind of different scenarios. It's definitely like surrealism light, maybe. Like, there's definitely some episodes that are like full blown. The humor is like full blown surrealism. It's almost like watching a live action cartoon. That's kind of the main thrust of it, I would say. That's what kind of carries, you know, each episode to the next. The project originally was called Bits and Pieces, and the kind of the creator's idea for the series originally, they had worked on other television shows, and, you know, part of the writing process is, you know, you come up with a scene that might be funny, but ultimately it doesn't necessarily work for the plot line of an episode, so it kind of just gets cut. And they kind of had the idea to make a show that was like kind of almost exclusively those moments, those funny moments, those vignettes. And then, you know, you get a sense of who the family is and who the characters are from those, rather than necessarily having like the traditional moving from point A to climax to conclusion in each episode. You know, that as that, Disney apparently liked that idea, and it eventually morphed into what Liv and Maddie became. And it, you know, it's a little bit more plot centric than I think their idea for Bits and Pieces were, but in a lot of respects, it is definitely like these kind of self-contained set pieces that kind of get strung together through some fourth wall breaks, which kind of at the very end of the series, as I mentioned in the article, you discover that the fourth wall breaks are actually, them having their kind of one-on-one with the camera of a reality show that was the backbone of the entire series, that you don't learn about until the season finale, that the entire thing was basically a reality show documenting the sister Liv, who was had a child actress, an aspiring singer, who had moved back to Wisconsin to kind of have a slightly more normal family life and spend time with her sister in high school. So that's kind of, yeah, the general plot of it. It's very, you know, the humor is very silly. You know, I think there's enough in it that's kind of, there's enough smart in it for people who are older, like myself. But obviously, like, you know, Disney knows what their demographic is, and there's plenty of humor in there that's going to appeal to, you know, your 12-year-old cousin, too.
Well, I think we'll wrap up on the Liv and Maddie thing just by talking a little bit about, in your in your essay, one of the things you really drive home is how the series finale really illustrates that balance between sentimentality and irony, especially with some of the characters' speeches or monologues in the episode and whatnot.
Yeah, the writing in that particular I mean, it's really, I think, probably my favorite series finale, like, hands down, not just for a kid show, but period. It's like they really kind of encapsulate everything that made the show great if you were a viewer, and then, like, things that made the show great if you were somebody who worked on the show, which, you know, as I note in the article, it's kind of like a very meta-modern thing to kind of collapse that distance between you know, the viewer and the people who are putting on the show. There's definitely, like, a lot of scenes where it starts as a story piece, and then you can see it's pretty much the actors getting a chance to tell each other, like, how great it's been to work with each other and how much they're going to miss, you know, not having this be such a part of their lives on a day-to-day basis. Yeah, it's just really, really, really good writing. When I first saw it, I was definitely kind of, you know, had been a fan of the show for years at that point, but I was just really kind of blown away by everything they were able to do in that series finale. And that's actually, watching that was kind of what cemented the idea in me to write that article. I actually, you know, kind of sent out a tweet at the time about how I was pretty sure that, you know, this might be the first, like, thoroughly meta-modern children's show, if not show, period. And that kind of caught the attention of two of the show's creators, and we had a small conversation about the themes that I thought I saw in there, and they actually encouraged me to write the essay, like, probably over a year ago, and when I kind of finished up the very rough version of it, it just didn't seem like I had necessarily a home to give it, and it kind of just sat there on my hard drive until I just happened to mention it casually to Jamie Curcio, who said, hey, we would probably like to have that. So I know you gave him shouts out at the beginning, but I'll give him another shout out for giving that article home. It definitely seems to have, you know, resonated with a lot more people than I anticipated. So that was definitely, like, a cool thing to discover.
Yeah. I wanted to mention that real quick. You actually had I think the creators of the show retweeted the article, spoke very highly of it. I think even did Dove actually retweet it as well?
She did, and she also, yeah, like, she sent out, you know, she posted it on her IG, and then on Twitter she gave, like, a really kind of caught me off guard, very heartfelt, emotional reaction to it, and, you know, feeling that it was, you know, that I had hit on things that they definitely felt and experienced making the show that they didn't necessarily bring up as part of the story overtly. And, you know, I think she said, you know, she felt really seen by me as a writer, which, you know, as a writer, that's, like, probably the best compliment you can get is that, you know, people feel like you have an insight into an experience that they have had. So that was, yeah, definitely very cool.
So moving on then from Liv and Maddie, unless there's anything else you want to close out on that topic with.
I think I'm good on that. Yeah. I think we hit everything.
I wanted to ask about this piece you also wrote a few days later, I think, for Modern Mythology called To the Bone. Which is your tribute to the recent passing of Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've been a fan of Anthony Bourdain, you know, since early 2000s, probably, you know, when he was primarily just writing essays. He loved his books. He loved all his various TV shows. Yeah, you know, as my fiance would say, he was a man crush, as it were. And yeah, I woke up and as per usual, I, like most Americans, grabbed my phone and see what's been happening while I was unconscious, and saw that news. And, you know, it definitely, as the day went on, it hit me more and more, and I kind of just wanted to kind of get it out through the best way I know how, which for me is writing. You know, I think, like I say in that article, I think it's, you know, kind of, it's obviously anyone's going to be sad when a famous person dies, because they, for better or for worse, like, you feel a connection to people who get famous doing something creative. There's kind of an NMC that happens even though you don't know those people, don't interact with those people, art is just kind of naturally a medium of connection. But I think he was also very uniquely, his perspective was very uniquely American. So I think it's kind of a blow to American storytelling too, especially kind of at a time where we, you know, voices like his are important. Fortunately, his work is always still going to be there.
So what about Bourdain do you see as uniquely American? And also, I noticed you sort of compare him to Hunter S. Thompson. If you could delve into those two things.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think with like the Hunter S. Thompson comparison, my first introduction to Thompson was Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail. My eldest uncle just had it in his bathroom, and this is, you know, pre-smartphones. So when you were in the bathroom, you read a book or a magazine instead of playing with your phone, and because that's what was in there, I started reading it. I am definitely a big Hunter S. Thompson fan. For me personally, I still kind of felt like sort of the way that I might feel when I listen to Bad Brains or something like it's great, but it was like just a little bit too far before my time for me to really feel like it's anything more than a history lesson, even though like obviously he was around writing, you know, when I was a kid. I just, for whatever reason, I just always saw him as like the cool thing that like my older brother, if I had an older brother, would have been into rather than my own thing. With Bourdain, like, I think he was definitely like one of the first people to see how food and culture, create the story of how we are. And even though there's, differences from culture to culture, like there's definitely a human connection that kind of transcends that. And you get at those commonalities. You can get at those commonalities through like something like a shared meal. Everybody knows what that experience is like. And to me, like that's kind of where their similarity is that they kind of both had an outside way of looking at the culture and what was happening in the world. Like when, Bourdain's first book, like he's looking at kind of behind the scenes on the restaurant industry. And obviously like, in his mind, like that book was really only going to be interested to people who were from his industry. And obviously that wasn't the case. And I think going from that point forward up until, his last shows for CNN, it's a constant build of like him realizing like the scope of what that small initial insight had been and into how, our differences are pretty easily breachable. And a lot of the division that we see between each other is kind of fabricated. As far as him being uniquely American, I think all you have to do is look at like some of the music that he was into, because you can really kind of feel its imprint on his writing. So like the two big ones that come to mind immediately are Screaming Trees and then of course the Stooges. And like the Stooges in particular, like to me that is like, England has the Stones and we have the Stooges. Like it's rock and roll, but that's like the American version, the pinnacle, the most pure essence. You listen to like an album like Raw Power and it's rock, but it's American rock. And in the same respect, obviously no matter what country you go to, there's people who write about food and there's people who do travel writing. But to me, when you read Bourdain, like he's the American version of that.
And you also, near the end of the article, you talk about Bourdain as, you say that the stories he told as a storyteller were a kind of medicine for a sick world. What do you see there? Like, why was what he was doing such a antidote?
Well, I think kind of going back a little bit to some of what we kind of were talking about with the Liv and Maddie thing, where we kind of segue there briefly into the whole, alt-right sort of culture clash thing that seems to be dominating a lot of the public discourse right now. I think Bourdain was somebody who, was definitely kind of a man's man. which, you know, for better or for worse, probably for worse, you know, if you have politics at all that are on towards the left these days, you know, as the alt-right crowd, they want to portray all those people as quote unquote soy boys. You know, and so I think Bourdain is somebody like you're not going to look at him and be like, oh yeah, he's, you know, some skinny vegan kid that thinks he knows better. Like, he's somebody who's, you know, does Brazilian jiu-jitsu and he swears and he smokes pot. Like, he's not, you know, that sort of like straw man of the always offended, hyper liberal individual. You know, but at the same time, like, he cared about those same things. You know, his, you know, very early on, you know, pointing out that, hey, like, it's Mexicans who are behind the success of the restaurant industry in this country. And that's, you know, immigrant labor and undocumented labor is in large part what this country runs on. And, you know, if you actually care about this country, then you should be respectful of those people who are actually helping to build it rather than arguing that they're all criminals who need to be deported. You know, he was, you know, very recently with the whole Me Too movement, like, he was extremely vocal about, you know, supporting his girlfriend with her act, you know, with her coming forward with what, Weinstein did to her.
You mean Asia Argento, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I think all of that was important. And, you know, increasing, like, on his shows, he would, you know, go to war-torn countries or, you know, parts of our own country where things aren't so great, you know, middle America, that place is being ravaged by, you know, Oxy and all that kind of, like, horrible things, people who don't have a voice and kind of, you know, that are easy to ignore, whether you're, you know, this sort of prototypical liberal elite on one of the two coasts who doesn't really care much about what's happening in the Rust Belt, or whether you are one of those people who, you know, wants to put America first. I think he had a way of saying, like, you know, that all these stories matter, that there's responsibilities we have as a human being. You know, it's sort of like, a lot of times, you know, these kind of, like, internationalism or multicultural themes, like, so often they're kind of really just, like, it's a corporate advertisement. It doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't really go anywhere. And I think his stories kind of had a way of bringing it to, like, you know, we can have our differences, but at the same time, you know, we're all human. We all suffer from the human condition. And so we kind of may as well try to make the world as good and easy as we can for each other.
Yeah, I like what you said about how what he did was an example of, quote, the dream of a multicultural world that's authentic, vibrant, and full of potential.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like, where I grew up, you know, I mean, it was still probably majority white, but you know, most of my friends were not white. And that's definitely, like, influenced me. I think it's, like, probably why, you know, when I was younger, I was probably, like, a lot of younger people kind of thought of myself as a libertarian before I had really thought libertarianism all the way through.
Glad I'm not the only one that went through that.
Yeah. But, you know, I think for me, like, growing up where I did, like, you know, my very first best friend was black. And I saw the way he got treated, and it wasn't, you know, and I was in a lot of ways a way worse kid than he was. Like, he's a pretty straight, narrow kid, but he's the one who got the suspicion 9 times out of 10. So it's like, you know, especially online where people, like, they have their own prefabricated narratives. Like, if your politics appear to be coming from the left, they already have decided they know what your life was like. For me, it's like, I didn't, you know, my politics are definitely to the left. And a lot of it is not because I sat down and read a book on theory, but it's like, I grew up with black and brown kids, and, like, I'm not going to have a politics that fucks those people over. Like, those are people I care about. Like, I was just saying, my first best friend is black. We're still in contact. Like, he lives on the other side of the country. I haven't seen him since we were kids, but, you know, through the miracles of Facebook, you know, we still talk occasionally. I get Christmas cards from him and everything. So it's like, I'm not going to have, you know, a politics that is going to fuck him over. And I, and like, to me, that's kind of like what's great about Bourdain, is that he kind of is humanizing people to the point where it's like, it's not about necessarily like having opinions based on, you know, I'm a leftist or I'm a libertarian or whatever ideology you've decided to cling to. It's kind of realizing like, hey, like, how about whatever your particular views are, don't adopt a view that specifically depends on like fucking over some other kind of person.
And near the end of the article, you get into, of course, it's unavoidable, his suicide and how that really for you has cut to the bone, and you sort of get into feeling a kinship with him. What's that all about?
So, yeah, I mean, like I said earlier during the Liv and Maddie segment, you know, I've got, I guess probably calling them skeletons in my closet is not entirely accurate because I have talked about it. But, you know, when I was younger, I sold pills and I sold heroin and I sold meth a couple times and was not a good person. I robbed people, all that kind of bullshit that some young men unfortunately get caught up in.
And Bourdain was sort of involved in like the drug scene too, right?
Yeah, he was a very heavy drug user, used heroin. And to me, that was like a big part of the kinship, was seeing him talk about, like, he 100% like knew, and this is something like I've been saying for years, even before I necessarily divulged the extent of my involvement in that world, was like, you know, hey, like, the reality is like, if you're involved in that life, like, you're supporting bad people who do bad things. And I, you know, obviously, like, I'm more or less on the straight and narrow these days, as straight and narrow as an artist can be. Yeah, I mean, I feel a tremendous sense of guilt over the things that I did. And he definitely did too. You know, he gave interviews where, you know, he wondered and felt pretty sure and obviously felt guilty about the fact that his heavy drug use probably contributed to, you know, the death of somebody, whether it was somebody in the States or somebody in Colombia, whatever the case may be. And, you know, for me, like, survivor's guilt is definitely like something I've wrestled with for most of my life. You know, like, despite all the nonsense that I was involved in, like, I managed to evade arrest. I never paid any like real serious consequences other than like a lot of dead friends and a lot of burnt bridges. But, you know, I can get a job anywhere. I don't have a criminal record. I didn't lose years of my life behind bars or anything like that, even though like the reality is I should have. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I would see most people talk about drug use, even if they were talking about heavy drug use, is just kind of like as a personal choice issue. And like, it's not really that, unfortunately. You know, those drugs all come from someplace, and you know, there's definitely a body count associated with it. And if you are, you know, a participant in it, like, you do have some level of culpability. And that's something I've always struggled with. And hearing him speak on that was really where I kind of felt, it was like really the first person I saw who kind of was expressing that same kind of guilt for the same reasons. Now, obviously, like, Q is more entrenched on the user end of things. And I was more on, you know, not that I don't want to give the impression like I was some, you know, pushing weight or making big moves or anything like that, but, you know, it is what it is. But, yeah, that kind of like, oh, this is somebody who gets it. Like, this kind of guilt that I've had that I felt like nobody around me could really appreciate, especially because I left, you know, when I was in my early 20s, like, I left Massachusetts where I was born, and anybody that I, you know, had ties to pretty much from that part of my life, like, I just walked out on it. Like, I realized, you know, I was heading nowhere good, either dead or in jail, and I didn't really want either of those at that point in time, or at least didn't want them enough to stick around and get them. And I just kind of walked out on all of it. And, you know, once I was away from that is when the guilt really kind of hit. And seeing Bourdain kind of talk about that, I definitely felt the kinship based on that, because all the people that I made friends with after that point, like, really weren't from that world. They didn't really, you know, they just didn't have those experiences. They weren't going to, they don't go to bed wondering, like, you know, what part they may have played in somebody being dead because you were being selfish and greedy.
Yeah. And speaking of people being selfish and greedy, I've been, I don't know nearly as much about Anthony Bourdain as most people who have been mourning over this are, but I've been really upset recently with how people are. I know a lot of people that are really exploiting his passing, saying, "Oh, why would someone as rich as him kill himself?" Or people that are just using this to say, "Oh, call the prevention hotline." These things are a lot more difficult than people understand, I think.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. You know, like, I give a little bit more of a pass on people sharing the suicide hotline.
Definitely.
That's partially, like, something shitty happens and you kind of want to feel like you could stop it. And obviously you can't bring somebody back to life, but you want to believe that maybe you can stop the next time from happening. So, like, I kind of have a little bit more sympathy for that, even though I do think that the issue with Bourdain, and I think increasing suicide rates in the country in general, is bigger than, like, you know, a hotline. You know, like, we all have our phones with us constantly. There's definitely kind of a cruel irony to the idea that help is a phone call away. It's like, we're always on our phones all the time. We're always, you know, talking to somebody or at somebody, or there's people that can see our thoughts. Like, we spend so much of our time, you know, like, when I was a kid, like, I would go hours without talking to another human being. Not anymore. Like, even if I'm at home alone, like, chances are I'm, like, shooting somebody a comment on Facebook or on Twitter or wherever. So there's a little bit of an irony there, like I was saying. And as far as people who are, you know, how can somebody who has this great life, you know, feel depressed? Like, I mean, I don't know how you can convince those people any differently. But to me, you know, like, I've definitely, you know, I've been homeless before, and I'm not homeless now. I'm not, you know, super rich, and I'm not famous. I'm not traveling, not getting paid to travel across the world and eat great food or anything like that. But, you know, it just doesn't really matter. I guess at the end of the day, like, you know, the things that you feel guilty for, like, no amount of material success is going to take that away, which is, like, it seems kind of obvious to say it. And that's kind of, like, what pisses me off a little bit about people saying is, like, oh, but he had this great life. But it's like, okay, but if you knew when you were, you know, 18 or 22 or however old that you really fucking screwed somebody over and hurt them badly, like, 20 years later, being rich, like, isn't going to change that. And you can't, you know, you can't necessarily go back and make those things right. And especially, like, when it comes to, you know, drug abuse, like, I'm sure there's plenty of people listening who, you know, have been, who are addicts or who've had addicts in their life. Like, you know, you can't make up for the shit you do when you're strung out. Like, that's just, if you treat somebody badly, that's just how it is. So to me, it's kind of like a little bit disingenuous to say, why would somebody who's super wealthy or successful or, you know, have a family kill themselves? It's like, well, you know, if you feel a tremendous set of guilt or if you are clinically depressed, like, it's just not a rational place to be. Like, I know, you know, that there's, it's not productive for me to feel guilty about having made it out of a previous life unscathed or at all. You know, it's not going to bring those people back. It's not going to undo any of the hurt that I caused. But, you know, even though I logically know that, like, you feel what you feel regardless. So, I mean, that to me is the big thing with asking that question is, like, I don't know, like, just be a little bit honest with yourself about what it's like to be a human being and to be alive. Is that, like, your own internal landscape is not really ruled by reason. And, you know, we're not a balancing book, you know, where you get to match up your red ink and your black ink. And as long as the black ink is larger, you're doing okay. It just doesn't really work that way. Like if you feel guilty or if you, you know, have mental illness, like, then that's just how it is. And no amount of success is going to change that.
Well, I just want to say for my part, suicidal ideation and depression cut across class lines. It cuts across class lines. And the people, I don't even know if they're being disingenuous, but they're certainly being tone deaf.
Well, I mean, I think part of it is, I'm sure there's, I have to imagine, like, a certain amount of jealousy, because it's like, you know, what the fuck? Like, this guy had what seems to be a great life. You know, what right does he have to throw that life away? I just don't think there's a point in thinking that way. And it, like you said, it does cut across class lines. You would think that would be like a clue into like, yeah, like obviously we know that people who are rich and people who are poor commit suicide for various reasons or for seemingly sometimes no reason. So that's just how it is. Like, I mean, to me, it should also be obvious just from this, from a purely biological standpoint. Like, obviously, you know, your biology is hardwired for survival. So, you know, the idea that suicide is like, you know, a logical choice is clearly not that. Like, if, you know, whether it's, you know, somebody who's, you know, thinking about suicide constantly, or, you know, people who actually go through with it. Yeah, that's not, it's not like somebody sat down and decided like, I'm going to be suicidal today. Like it's just something that's kind of really beyond the control of the individual. And maybe that's kind of why people want to have that conversation of like, I don't get it. His life is so great. And the same thing with like the hotline thing. You want to feel like everyone wants to feel like they have 100% control over their lives at all times, but I mean, that's just not really how it is, you know. Especially when I was younger, like I definitely had, you know, some real close calls to where, you know, I really thought about ending it, you know, hanging out near train tracks and really being like one rash decision away from stepping out in front of a train or from jumping off a bridge. You know, and I didn't. And I can't tell you today, like, why I didn't and somebody else did. It's not like I didn't have some sudden epiphany about, like, all the great shit in life that I had to live for, or, like, that it suddenly occurred to me that maybe life would be better at some point. It's just that, like, for whatever reason, and that second, rather than step in front of a train, it didn't. But it very could have easily gone the other way, and obviously, and I think that's probably with a lot of people who do end up successfully killing themselves. It's kind of like, you know, if I'd had a gun, maybe it would have been a little bit different. Like, it's a split second to pull that trigger, and there's no room for regret left afterwards. So I think probably with like a lot of people, even if somebody has really given a lot of time and thought to how they want to kill themselves, I think it ultimately comes down to that, like, that one split moment. And I don't necessarily know that it's like a rational choice. I think it's just some people pull the trigger and some people don't, and there's not really going to be a way to know who's going to do it and who's not or when. So yeah, and I think that's the case with, you know, Bourdain had talked about previously about feeling suicidal, and he knew what he had to live for. Like in the interviews he talked about his daughter and being in love, and, you know, but at the same time, you know, if you feel that pull, like you feel that pull, it's, and it just happened to be, you know, when he's alone in a hotel room, like the pull got the better of him. You know, maybe if he had another few moments, he wouldn't have done it, but that's just not how it played out. So that's the thing to me with people wanting to moralize about it, is I just don't really think that suicide is necessarily a moral issue, even though obviously like it hurts the people that care about you. I just think that a person who's in that situation, you know, the amount of of pain or loneliness or you know, just not being in your quote unquote right mind. Like, it's just, it's too rare and unique of a mindset for you to be able to map onto that something like morality, which is more to do with like your everyday decision making process when you have time to think things through. And I think somebody who's like really depressed, you know, who's really like really, really thinking about killing themselves, like, it just isn't like that. I know for me, you know, I spend, you know, an inordinate amount of time thinking about ethics and morality, partially because of the fact that when I was younger, I didn't think about that and justified doing a lot of really terrible things. But when I think back to those periods of my life where I was suicidal, it's just a different mindset. You can't really explain it. It doesn't correlate to anything else. If you've been in that position and you get it, and if you haven't, I don't know that anyone's going to be able to explain it to you. But yeah, it's just not one of those situations where you're making, where you have like a normal decision making process, or morality is even really entering into the situation.
I want to ask, what do you think we can do as a society and a community to sort of deal with this issue? Because as you know, suicide rates are actually increasing.
Yeah, I mean, like, honestly, I don't really know. I wish I had a concrete answer. Like, I have suspicions, you know. I think, you know, in a lot of ways, I think despite the fact that we seem more connected through social media, I think we're actually probably more alienated than ever. You know, I think just the fact that you have, you know, one group of young people, like, you know, who hate the other group of people, they think they're completely opposites. But if you actually, you know, look at their behavior, they're actually behaving in pretty much the same way, which would tell you they're actually probably experiencing the same thing, that kind of really deep alienation. And whether they've turn to right-wing politics or left-wing politics, like, that's, it's like their attempt to try and transcend that alienation. And like, politics, it's not therapy. Like, it's not going to make those things better. So, you know, I think honestly, you know, to take kind of a cue from what Bourdain's career was like, you know, seek out genuine connection, seek it out with people who aren't like you, who don't think like you, who aren't from the same places as you. You know, I think art can be somewhat therapeutic for part of that. I just really think, like, especially when I log on to Facebook, it seems like everybody thinks there's going to be a political solution to all this stuff. I'm not the world's greatest political thinker, but increasingly I kind of think it's got to start before that. It's got to come from really just relating to each other on a human level. And unfortunately, I don't even know that you can do that through social media. Like, as much as you know, you're talking to a lot of people, or you get to know people from different parts of the world, like, it's still like you in a room typing on a screen. There's just something inherently alienating about it. And like, I feel almost a little hypocritical saying that, because like, so many people I know, you, Jamie Curcio, a lot of the artists that I work with, I never would have met if it hadn't been for the internet. So, I mean, obviously you can forge good connections, but I think as social media and the internet have kind of become more entrenched in our lives, it's really exacerbated that alienation. And I mean, who knows, maybe, you know, younger kids who don't really remember, who will never like know a world where that just wasn't the norm, maybe they'll figure out a way to adapt to it. But yeah, I think the main thing is just putting, like, be willing to talk to and spend some time with people who aren't like you. I think is a pretty solid way to not feel so alienated. Like, it sounds, you know, maybe a little trite, but like, honestly, like, go do some charity work. like, for me, you know, spending time like helping to feed the homeless and stuff, like, you know, you go into it to help them, but it really does kind of give you some perspective on humanity. And that's what I think is missing. Like, you know, you're not, it's going to be real hard to do that, like, online. It just because people who are different, like, the mode online is argument. Like, everything's an argument. Even if you agree with somebody, you're probably going to be arguing about how much you agree at some point. But if you actually go out into your community and deal with the people who are there, who have stories and backgrounds and fears and hopes and dreams, you know, you're not going to go yell at those people the same way that you do online. It's an unnatural way to communicate with people. Like, there's positives to it for sure, but I think the negatives that come from it can't be overcome by just immersing yourself more in that medium. Like, you have to go out into the world, like, to kind of bring it full circle. Like, that to me, when I think about, you know, my time as a young person in the hardcore punk scene, like, I've seen so many shows, and like, a lot of them I barely remember them. What I remember is, you know, people I met, hanging out with people, meeting new people. That's to me where, I mean, like, the music is great, don't get me wrong, but to me, that was what the real value and like being part of that scene was, you know, connecting with other people. You know, obviously we all had a love for the same kind of music, but a lot of us came from, you know, different walks of life and different parts of the country and had seen different things and had different ideas about how the world worked and how we wanted it to work. You just can't replace that. You can't go online and get that, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I think, you ended the Bourdain tribute in a very nice way by saying that Bourdain has inspired you and no doubt many others to tip the scales of this world toward beauty, justice, and love. I really like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's like, for me, like, a lot of the fiction work I do in particular, you know, is kind of on the dark side. And, you know, definitely, like, having him, you know, having him die so soon after I wrote that Liv and Maddie article also kind of like really cemented into me, like, you know, how important it really, like, you know, if you're a grown adult and, you know, you've seen a thing or two, it's easy to feel jaded, but that, like, those kind of two, that kind of the highs of like connecting with, you know, artists whose work had meant a lot to me and now who were able to show me appreciation back, like, that was like a real high point. Like, and it's just like the way it is, like, if you write stories, man, like, the chance that you're ever gonna hear real feedback on something you write, it's so slim. Like, maybe someone tells you they really liked it, but that's about the extent to it. If you write something that's a little bit more on the nonfiction end of things, at least from my experience, the feedback tends to be a little more specific. So like, that was like a real high point in my life as a writer. It seems like even more so than like getting published for the first time, that kind of like genuine feedback. And then to go into that, to the real low of like, oh shit, this person whose work I really liked and, you know, who I felt like a kinship with for some real like weird specific reasons, dying, kind of really cemented in me that, like, corny or not, like, yeah, like, that's what I want to do. That's what I want my art to do, is to kind of say, hey, as fucking bad as shit can be, like, you know, we still have to, like, go forward and, you know, focus on how can we make things better and how can we kind of appreciate each other a little bit more.
Well, before we close out here, is there anything you're working on now that you would like to mention or plug?
Well, you know, my website, cell144.com, always trying to post the poetry and fiction up there. I've got, in theory, I've been working on a novel for a long, long, long time now, and just about have that in the tank. So that should be hopefully being published with maybe in the next year or so. That'll be called Harmony Hill. So I guess people can look out for that. Obviously, any place they can find me on social media or my website, they'll have info about that. So those are the main things.
Okay, well, thank you for coming on Parallax Views, Brian Shaughnessy.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my interview with Brian Shaughnessy. Check out his website, cell144.com. That's C-E-L-L, the number 144.com, to learn more about his writing and other creative projects. Gonna close out the show this time with a cover of the hardcore band Integrity's Psychological Warfare by Shade of Mankind. Check them out, folks.